I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Kyo Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
For a special Skinon podcast, we caught up with Atlantic director Richard O'Dowd.
You had a bit of a struggle with financing for the film, not getting it together, the financial, you know, so.
Yeah, it's the subject matter, I suppose, doesn't endear itself towards, you know, official Ireland.
Yeah.
It's a story about what's happening to our natural resources offshore, our coastal communities, and, you know, I suppose the media and the state in general hasn't been very good to our coastal communities. As a nation, we've turned our back on the sea. You know, throughout our history, our culture, we've always seen the sea as associated with tragedy or penance or immigration, negative things, as opposed to Norway and Newfoundland, where the rest of the story is based. The sea is a great resource. The coastal communities, the fishermen are something to be celebrated. They're a big driver of the economy there. In Ireland, we handed away our resources, and to, I suppose it's a great embarrassment to the country. And it's been very difficult to actually say, you know, to go to someone and say, I want to make this film, because it's so important, I think, anyway. But when I didn't get funding from the official bodies, I just hit a brick wall everywhere I went. I just put out on crowdfunding and funded. And we broke the crowdfunding record on their site, raised €56,000 through two different crowdraising
crowdfunding schemes, yeah.
Yes, and then, you know, kept the film more, allowed me to go to Norway and Newfoundland, build up more the story. And we got support in Canada through their broadcaster, CBC, and the Newfoundland Labrador Film Development Corporation, and then the Film Fund in North Norway, NRK, their broadcaster, and then the Film Board here in Ireland agreed to match the crowdfunding amount. So, you know, we got there in a roundabout way.
Yeah. And what drew you then to those particular communities in Norway and in Newfoundland?
What was funny was in Newfoundland, what drew me to the communities in Newfoundland was that they were very Irish. You know, I was looking at this story in Ireland, I was trying to get context. I was like, what communities can I compare this with?
Yeah.
And I suppose Newfoundland came to mind, really, because I'd seen this Ryark documentary years ago called The Forgotten Irish. And it's these people over in Newfoundland, and they were talking exactly like down in County Waterford or Wexford. And I was like, well, that'd be fascinating to do a comparison. So I went to Newfoundland, and it was just incredible, you know. Even to this day, like, people talking like, how's it going, boy, there now, how are you doing? And, like, they've been in Canada for six generations, you know. It was mad. And that was really interesting, because in Canada, in Newfoundland, the state had handed over control. The central government handed over control of the fishing resources. And basically, the factory ships had cleaned out the Grand Banks. Once the greatest fisheries in the world, you know, where Perfect Storm was filmed.
Yeah.
Or animated, whatever. And they said, you know, you could walk across the backs of the cod in the Grand Banks. They were so thick. And to see those communities just almost wiped out because of just greed and factory trawling, destructive fishing practices. It was a real lesson for Ireland, where we've just allowed everybody in our fishery. We just handed it away. And the super trawlers that have been kicked out of Africa and Australia and America are in Irish waters for months of the year, you know. And we're reaching a tipping point. So that was a lesson. And then what Newfoundland did with their oil resources, oil and gas resources. And Norway, I suppose, has always been the poster child of resource management around the world. So I went to Norway to see what was going on. How come they had managed their resources so well? Their oil, their fishing, everything else. And that was a real eye-opener to look at the contrast between the development of their state and our state. And then the Norwegian story was interesting, because the once great Norwegians, you know, these great fisheries and these great oil reserves, the oil in the south is running low, prices are low, so they're having to move up into the Arctic to pump more oil, discover more oil. And this is leading to a conflict with the cod fishermen. It's this amazingly rich cod fishery, varied fishery in the Arctic, but there's oil underneath those fishing grounds. And this is where the battle is. So now the Norwegian, you know, the perfect Norwegians are starting to dirty their bib, because they need to move into the fishing grounds, and that's causing conflict. So the question posed, and across the whole Atlantic, in Ireland and Newfoundland as well, is that, you know, do we look at our renewable resources, develop them over the long term? You know, there might be a quick buck in it, like the oil, but do we develop it for generations to come, and so that coastal communities, big and small, all around the country, can benefit long term? Or do we look at the short term, fast buck, destructive processes? And that's kind of what frames the question within the film. You know, from back in the 70s, from how we all managed our resources to the present day, were fishermen and different people along the coast are just trying to make a living, you know, learn from these mistakes that we've made in the past. And they're very, very directly laid out in the documentary.
Anyway, there's no harm. I mean, some of the, because you can have, you have those sort of two schools of thought on documentary. You have the ones where you sit back and you let the story unfold, and then you, or you have to try find the story in the edit suite. Or then you have the ones where you're driving the, and to a certain extent there's an agenda attached to them, and the impartiality is kind of gone out the window. But they can still be absolutely fascinating, like Blackfish or Look Silence or any of these ones. There's no real counter argument to, you can't go, well, the genocide was actually good in Indonesia.
Well, sometimes something is blatantly wrong, you know, exactly. And you have to call it like it is. Sometimes balance, you know, journalists often kind of seek this kind of balance which can't be found.
Yeah.
And you need to have, you know, sometimes you need to have a contribution from all sides. Now, in Atlantic, I mean, I don't know, do you think it was balanced or not, but there has to be a certain amount of balance in this documentary. My last documentary, The Pipe, there was no balance. It was a perspective. Shell wouldn't get involved. They wouldn't engage. The government wouldn't. It was an honest perspective from the local community's point of view.
Yeah.
And it showed them warts and all. It wasn't supposed to be this overall kind of picture. Whereas Atlantic is quite different documentary. I'm coming to this, I'm trying to tell a story from all these different angles, but I need to tell it in a more informative way, while also being a human, engaging story and entertaining. So I've needed to bring in that balance because of the nature of that story. I've needed voiceover. I've needed a lot more facts and figures. I need to back it up with information. You know, it's cost me $6,000 in errors and emissions insurance, it's called. So all the facts and figures are rock solid. Because we are making claims about the big industrial fishing companies. We're making claims about the oil industry. And we need to back these up. You know, we can't just make up stuff and show it out there.
They have huge legal counsel.
Absolutely, They take it to the cleaners, you know. So this is a different documentary, and it is a bit more structured, and it has to be that way because you don't want the audience at the end of 80 minutes picking their eyeballs up off the floor and thinking, what the hell was that about? It was just overloaded with information and all over the place. It was quite a difficult narrative to edit, and that's why Nigel O'Regan, the editor, was very clever at using the Atlantic Ocean to weave the story together. So even though we have three communities in Ireland, Newfoundland and Norway, separated by thousands of miles, different cultures, everything, it's the Atlantic that kind of pulls them in together.
Yeah, you can see the movement of the waves moving towards one village or one community or whatever. It's an absolutely beautiful documentary. It's gorgeous to look at, you know.
Yeah.
Especially the opening few minutes when you're coming over the ice in Canada and all this. You're like, mother of God, this place looks amazing. You know?
Yeah, we're so blessed. I mean, with the ocean we have, that's what gets me. Like, and I'm from inland. I'm from Tipperary, we're surrounded by mountains, not water, and. But Jesus, to realise this incredible wealth of our ocean, like, our sovereign territory is 10 times the size of our land area. 90% of it is underwater. And as a people, as a state, we've turned our backs on the sea. You know, we understand property, we understand, you know, land, cattle, all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to the sea, unlike the Norwegians, the Canadians, we don't appreciate it. And if we could get some kind of appreciation of it, I think our country would be far richer, a far better place. And these coastal communities all around the country are so rich, you know. But they're often rich in non-financial ways. How do you put a price on the social fabric of a community? You know, it's from a bureaucrat in Dublin looking at this, going, like, these are just a nuisance. If we moved all these into a big town, we wouldn't have to pay for all these services. You know, we could let the big fishing boats go off and fish more efficiently and, you know, make more money or look better in the balance sheet. So how do you actually get that story across that, you know what, small fishing communities and you know, not just the big industrial boats, and the fabric of small fishing communities and what they stand for is really worth preserving, and it needs to be fought for. And the political will has never been there in Ireland to stand up for fishermen. It also has been there for farmers, for shopkeepers, but never for fishermen. And I hope that changes.
Yeah, it's kind of mad because you see the likes of Nationwide, or you have on UTV Ireland, you have the farming programs or whatever, but there aren't any dedicated to looking at fishing, you know.
That's one thing I found very difficult, is that I found it hard to get. Now, there are, there's like Seascapes on RT Radio, and there's a few, you know, that do. The Irish Times, Lorna Siggins covers the marine, but they're in the mainstream, it's very hard to find, you know, a lot about fishing and coastal communities or resources. The 90% of our territory that's not on land, And that's where I hit a brick wall. There was no kind of appreciation or no understanding of why the story was important among broadcasters or film funds or things like that, you know. But thankfully, you know, slowly we're kind of convincing him that there is an audience, especially with the crowdfunding, there is an audience, there is an appetite. And hopefully more will come on board and, you know, they'll see it. It's not necessarily a confrontational documentary. It's a documentary that's supposed to invite people in and actually provoke thought, get people talking about these subjects, you know, and engaging with them. I think it's so important to get that across.
Yeah, and for the fisheries community, it's seeing their way of life reflected in a way that they usually are not. You know, so.
Yeah, often we hear about fishing communities, it's either a tragedy, it's like if the news goes down to some fishing community far, far away, someone's died or someone's been arrested or there's something awful that's happened.
Yeah, or there's been the Gardaí have discovered an incredible amount of cocaine on a boat coming into, you know,
exactly,
Bear, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But that is the only thing we hear, like, you never really hear of it for positive stories or for just normal stories, you know. And I wish that would change, you know, and hopefully this goes some way towards that.
Yeah, because, I mean, historically speaking, we would have been a nation of seafarers. Granted, one of the reasons that we're fearful of the sea is the fact we were constantly invaded over the generations, but we would have ventured out. And to all the other places and the voyages of discovery.
Oh, like you go back to St. Brendan the Navigator.
Yeah.
He landed in Newfoundland, apparently, but, you know, it was proven that he could have. You know, Grania Whale, you know, Admiral Brown started the Argentinian Navy. We have a great tradition in our past of going out over the horizon, not really knowing what's over there and just going very boldly, you know, like Star Trek. I probably wish, you know, with invasion, I kind of put a stop to that. Because all these fellas, Vikings, and everything landed. Kind of going, oh, Jesus, no. Careful at sea. But I was young, actually. I mean, like, even, we were always kind of warned when I went to my holidays in County Mayo about the sea. You went up past your toes and you'd be pulled out. Oh, it's a big current in there and everything. There was a real kind of a fear, a mystery of the sea. They were saying, like, does this current, if you go up that far, does this current that'll grab you and land you above the lighthouse? So water's back, you'd be turned without looking for this current, you know.
Yeah.
It'd be like a fun slide or something to bring us around the bay. I'd never find it. But I think culturally there's that ingrained suspicion of the sea and all it stands for.
Yeah, because you see every so often you get massive storms and it wrecks havoc on certain areas. And all of our population centres, so all of our cities, bar one, are coastal.
That's right, yeah. I mean, we were founded. Our cities were founded by the Vikings, you know, to trade. And in the past, like, we've always traded by the sea. I mean, Ireland was covered by trees, and the best routes were run by sea. So we should be more outward-looking, you know. But definitely, and it's probably with the Land League and all that kind of stuff that happened in more recent history, that land has been the currency.
Yeah, it was because it was taken from us. And so now that the seas have been taken from us, is it not time to revolt? And
yeah, I think as a people, we always get more interested when we can't do something.
Yeah.
If we can't practice religion, we become very religious. If we can't have land, we go mental, you know? So maybe, yeah, if people realise that the seas and the resources have been taken from us, all of a sudden we'll become very, we'll have great eagerness for the sea. But it's not just as a financial thing, you know, it's such a great amenity. You know, to have the sea on your doorstep is just fantastic.
Yeah, and it's part of our natural beauty as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
The tourism board is selling the crap out of the Wild Atlantic Way.
You know? One more thing about the Wild Atlantic Way. It's been good, all right. It's all you hear.
Yeah, but now you have, I mean, there is a young culture that's embracing the sea again because of the surfing communities in around Clare and up to Sligo and all the rest.
Not if Donald Trump has his way. He wants to build a big wall across the beach in Doombeg in his hotel, ironically. Ironically, actually, to act against climate change, he doesn't believe in. But anyway, you know that his golf course down in Doombeg, he's been planning permission to build a big seawall to protect the dunes. And he's tried to get it as a strategic infrastructure project, so he doesn't have to go through the county council. I think it's ironic, anyway.
Yeah, no, it is. It's
but there was a battle there years back where they tried to stop surfers. The right away onto the beach is true. You know, I go surfing under too. You walk across the golf course onto the beach to go surfing. They wanted to block the surfers. But, I mean, no, it's one thing I'm looking forward to. Is actually, I've been filming this for so long, it's actually been able to have the film done and then just for the summer you know, go to different places around the country, show the film, like the Skull Film Festival up in Arnmore Island. Just be able to go there, bring the kids, and actually enjoy the place, you know.
Yeah,
have a day to do nothing, but when you can really appreciate and enjoy the sea, it's fantastic, you know. And I mean, like, as an island nation, not really appreciating the incredibly rich seafood we have and the advantages of that, you know. Everything about it is good, you know. If we can, if our Irish fishermen are allowed to catch a fair and sustainable quota of fish, if that can be sold locally, if we can eat more fish locally, the health benefits, economic benefits, everybody's a winner, you know. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, you can see that in that working in Norway as it is, the Norwegian standard of life is much higher than it is here. It's their, they benefit from it. Like, because when you get trees and all those are in, like natively in fish, so they benefit.
Then they look after their fisheries. They didn't join the EU. I mean, I'm pro-EU, but they didn't join the EU because they wouldn't give away the fisheries to the extent we did. We basically handed it over, so that most of our fish, vast majority of our fish, are caught by European boats. And they got a very, very vibrant fishing communities, you know, that you've ever from the smaller boats to the bigger boats. And if the stock is managed very well, prices, everything, selling it locally, nationally, exporting around the world, you know, really is a model that we need to look to.
Yeah, but there's other Scandinavian countries in there that are in the EU. So you have the likes of Sweden and those in Finland who would have, well, Finland in particular would have a big fishing community on there. And so it would be interesting to see how they get on versus, I mean, because we always hear the stories, oh, it's the Spanish fishermen that are up in the Irish waters. It's always, they're always... So it's mad. I mean, and Denmark would have, they have Greenland, so they are able to use that to their advantage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it'd be interesting to see what the other ones at a similar sort of latitude to ourselves, because the Spanish and the Portuguese have a completely different relationship with the sea.
Yeah, but you see, that's the thing, like Spain and France and that, their continental shelf drops off very quickly after about 10 miles, whereas in Ireland it goes out for up to 200 miles, which makes us very rich fisheries, because you have that shallow continental shelf that's vast. And that's why when we were negotiating to get into the EU, they could see our rich fisheries. I mean, our boats could only go about 10 or 20 miles, but they could see the prize off Ireland, and they made sure that they got a big chunk of that, you know. And they knew the value of the ocean. And I think especially with the future we're moving into now, and the value of ocean resources, not just oil and gas, not just fishing, but, you know, seaweed, different ocean resources, that we really need to invest in our ocean. Now, the minister, to a degree, is investing in ocean technologies and energy and all that, you know, which is good. There is some kind of recognition. Coveney, at least, is the first one to really push that. But when it comes to fishing and looking after fishing communities, it's just a lack of political will.
It's a great shame, because, I mean, politics in Ireland is very local, so it is very regional. So you would imagine that.
Yeah, but fishing communities have always been very small.
Yeah.
Even on the coast, the farming communities have been, they've been more unified. They've been much better organising politically. And the nature is different. Fishermen are, they're hunters. You know what I mean? They compete against each other out at sea. And they expect them to come in and, you know, all pull together and all sing off the same hymn sheet. It's much more difficult, you know?
Yeah, so isolationist to a big extent.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you could have 100,000 farmers on O'Connell Street in the morning. The IFA could.
Yeah.
You try to get 10 fishermen.
Because I remember reading as a kid, I used to read all the scientific magazines stuff as a kid, and they were always talking about what was in the ocean. So other than the fact that we have oil and gas down the bottom of every single ocean, there's loads of that, but getting to it is a pain in the backside.
Yeah.
But they were saying that you could harvest, there's huge deposits of manganese at the bottom of the Atlantic, and that you could...
But for batteries now, it's going electric cars, lithium, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's all down there. Yeah.
But even there's research... Incredible research going on, let's say, in anyway, Galway, where do you know these things like stents and scaffolds that you put into arteries in the heart to help rebuild tissue after heart disease and keep the arteries open?
Mm.
Instead of building these artificially in the lab, they're looking at how they can take them from nature. So these kind of materials that expand and contract and do that same job are already in nature under the sea. Because remember, our bodies are... They're an immersed environment. Under the skin, it's all water, like blood, you know?
Yeah.
So when we look at the ocean, we can find solutions to medical problems.
And all that are the sponges less... and stuff.
Exactly, right? Yeah. That can work with our bodies, in our bodies. And when their function is done, they just dissipate organically. And they're less likely to be rejected by the body because they're kind of organic.
Mm.
But the research into these scaffolds is incredible. You know, like a clothes horse, basically, that it comes up like that. and you can't see it.
No, but you can see, if you ever watch the movement, if you're on like a coral reef or whatever, you ever watch the movement of someone, the sponges in particular, they're always contracting into, like, they're essentially a gigantic lung kind of in the way that they move. It's very...
So that's where, you know, there's such a massive future in the ocean, you know, and it's time to realise that, because we are an island nation.
Yeah, sure, it took us up until very recently to actually chart a lot of it. You know, we don't... We?
Yeah, since the Brits charted it in, I don't know, 1810 or something, wherever it was, Brits had these really incredible sea infrastructure. And like, since whatever, 1900 when they did them or whatever, we never did them up until a few years ago. We were relying on the British maps, and there were the Coast Guard stations all around the country, you know. They knew, for a lot of reasons, why the sea was worth looking after and why it was worth holding on to.
Well, sure, their entire empire was built on the sea, so...
Exactly, yeah.
Well, thanks very much for...